Do schools kill creativity? When creativity expert Sir Ken Robinson first asked this question in a 2006 TED Talk, it soon became the most watched TED Talk of all time, and it remains so to this day.
Robinson was knighted by the British government for his research on creativity in education. He says the education system is failing students who have to compete in an increasingly global and digital age.
Robinson says our current emphasis on testing comes at the cost of creativity. He makes the case for revolutionizing education focus on individual students and spark their innate talent and their curiosity.
Joining us now is Sir Ken Robinson, author of several books on creativity and education, including the latest, Creative Schools, the Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. Sir Ken, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, your 2006 TED Talk asked if schools kill creativity. Your answer in a nutshell, yes, lots of education does. And it was the most viewed TED Talk ever. Why do you think it hit such a nerve?
I think because people recognize from their own education and the education of their children that they have talents that school didn't discover and didn't cultivate, and that it's important that they should. I should also say, by the way, that I had a huge response to the talk and to the work I do from teachers themselves and from school principals and school districts, because very often they feel that they're being frustrated in their attempts to give this education the sort of creative turn it really needs. They're being frustrated by this culture of standardization. So it wasn't an attack on schools at all. It was really, if anything, it was a defense of them.
Part of the reason that you say schools can kill creativity is because we're working off a model that grew out of the Industrial Revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a couple of strands to it. One is that public education as we know it now didn't really exist much before, in most countries, before the middle of the 19th century, and in some a bit later than that. These mass systems of education were developed at the height of industrialism, and it was to help supply, among other things, a workforce for the industrial economy. It's why we had such a broad base of elementary education, such a narrow base of university education. It was a model of the workforce we needed. It was largely manual with some professional and clerical people at the top. And the school system itself is modeled to some extent on the lines of industrial production. If you think of it, you know, we educate children by ages in batches. They go through the system in regular cohorts, you know, all the 8-year-olds together, all the 9-year-olds together. The day gets broken up into bits in high schools, into 40, 50-minute periods, and bells ring. We end up taking these things for granted, but really, these sorts of organizational techniques aren't necessary for good learning or good education. In some ways, they actually get in the way of it. I mean, you can imagine, couldn't you, if you're running a business on that basis where every 40 minutes everybody had to stop what they were doing and go to some other room and do something else, you'd be bankrupt in a week. And it doesn't really help learning either very much. So there are organizational features which are rooted in the industrial efficiency model. But also there's a hierarchy of subjects in schools which is related to what we think are going to be subjects most useful for getting work. And that hierarchy is also very questionable. And I suppose the last thing to say is that increasingly, since No Child Left Behind became the law here in America, there's a tremendous pressure of standardization and of relentless testing in schools. And that's really, I think, started to have damaging effects on the quality and nature of learning. And it's largely, in many ways, proven to be counterproductive.
Well, I want to get to that standardized testing. But first, you say that to get at how education should be reformed, we have to figure out what we think it's actually for. What is your answer to that question?
Well, education is one of those areas, you know, that raises the temperature in conversations very often, and there are good reasons for it, because we're very invested in it for ourselves, our children. There are all kinds of reasons why education matters. But it's one of those ideas, a bit like democracy and freedom and independence, where we all think we know what we mean by it, about it. We assume we agree until we start to talk about it and realize we have slightly different interpretations, sometimes radically different interpretations. Education's like that. For some people, it's all about getting a job. For some people, it's all about social control and things of that sort. So I argue in the book that before we can really talk about the sort of education we want, we at least ought to be clear what we mean by it and if we mean different things. My take on it is that education has a twin role, that it should help young people, or people of any age, discover the talents they have inside of them, and help them understand the world around them so that they can be fulfilled individuals and active and compassionate citizens. I think all that matters. We want people to leave school and go on to other education or to work, feeling confident in their own talents and abilities and able to be productive and engaged in their communities. But we also want people to be compassionate towards others and to be active in the well-being of communities and economically productive. So it's a broad range of things that education has to achieve. And for that reason, we need a broad curriculum and we need to be flexible in the way we set about educating people in our schools. And at the moment, the testing culture tends to limit things on all those fronts.
Well, right now, the United States, as you know, is having a rough time grappling with problems like the achievement gap and failing schools. And one proposed solution has been to come up with models for standardization, like at its basis, Common Core, No Child Left Behind. What do you think about that model of reform, trying to make sure that all kids get more or less the same information and knowledge and then using a standardized test to make sure?
Well, you know, it's all very well intentioned. There's no question about that. I work with school districts all across the country. I've lived here for about 15 years now. I've spoken with senior politicians of all parties. And I've no doubt of people's goodwill and good intentions. And No Child Left Behind, which is being reauthorized as we speak, is also full of all the right language. The problem is the strategy that's been adopted, which, as you say, is largely about standardizing and testing. And you have to separate things out a bit here. There's a big debate on just now about the Common Core. I mean, broadly speaking, I think there are good reasons to have a general agreement on the sorts of things that we ought to learn in common. I mean, for example, in mathematics and in some other disciplines and languages, we don't need to keep inventing these things. There's some value in saying, well, can't we agree on these at least that we ought to be covering? The testing issue is something a bit different. The No Child Left Behind provided or required that schools and districts have regular tests, particularly in languages and science and mathematics. And the consequence has been that these tests, they're called high-stakes tests for a good reason. They can affect funding, they can affect teachers' employment, they can affect whether principals are kept on or dismissed, and they affect resources for schools. It's become very competitive. And the result is that in practice in schools, kids spend a huge amount of time now either being tested or being prepared to be tested or being debriefed on the tests. Teachers spend hours and hours of time administering these tests, following up from the tests. It's become a testing culture, and parents don't like it, teachers don't like it, kids are being disengaged and disaffected by it. And it's also worth saying, Veronica, as I say in the book, this is a big business. This isn't just some benign process that well-intentioned educators have agreed to do to help standards go up. That may be the underlying idea, but this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's huge profits for private companies. It's one of the figures we found as we're looking at through this is that the NFL, the National Football League, in 2013 had overall receipts of about $9 billion. That's a big business. The U.S. domestic cinema box office was $11 billion. That's a big business, but the testing and educational support industry in the U.S. had receipts of over $16 billion. That's massive. And a lot of that goes to private companies. It's unregulated. There's more regulation in the production of pet food than there is in the testing industry in schools. And the result is it's narrowed the curriculum, and it's subverted the quality of education. It's not even raising standards in the way that people expected it would. And the reason is that education is a personal business. You know, it's not. It shouldn't be a steeplechase. It's about finding people's talents and unleashing the energies of schools so they can really encourage individual achievement and collective and collaborative work. And the book is, by the way, full of examples of schools that are doing that and getting much better results.
And you're saying you want a revolution based on that idea, the belief in the value of the individual. What does that look like?
It's not just the individual. I'm talking about I think what it comes to is this initially is that all children are different. That's the point. You know, this isn't a manufacturing process. It's a human process. If anybody listening to this thinks about their own children, you know, if they've got two or more, or even know of two or more children, I bet you they're completely different from each other. You know, you and I, would, you know, we have a lot in common by virtue of being, you know, human beings and living on the planet and sharing certain cultural backgrounds. But we're all different. You know, we have different talents, different interests. Human life is about diversity, and this standards culture is about conformity. And the so part of my argument, yes, is that we should recognize that these are real people being educated. They have interests and ambitions and hopes and aspirations, and we have to engage that for education to be successful for them. There's one example I'll just give you quickly is of a school. There are lots in the book. I mean, the book, it's not a theoretical book. I'm always very keen to say that. There are lots of good ideas, I hope, in the book that people will find interesting and inspiring, but it's really a book of practice and evidence. There's a school, for example, that we talk about in Georgia. It's called Smoky Road. It was a middle school, which had a bad reputation for a long time. Kids were regularly not showing up at school. There were lots of problems in the school when they did. And they had a new head teacher come in, Dr. Laurie Barron, who, she said, spent the first year jumping over desks and breaking up fights pretty much. And but then she and the teachers started to form a plan and work with the parents and the governor and the community, and they decided that really what they had to do was to get to know these kids properly and engage them properly. And as you put it, we realized that what mattered most to these kids is what really mattered. So there was one girl she talked about who loved music but really wasn't getting that kind of music education she needed in school. And so they helped her with that. They provided for it. And, I mean, she got much more involved and her grades overall improved. There's a lad who she said was a statistic waiting to happen at the age of 13. But football was his thing, but he wasn't really being encouraged. So they did and they engaged him in that. And she said over time they did this with all the kids, and they found that if they engaged children in things they loved to do and what mattered to them, then they were much more likely to do the things that matter to everybody else. And anyway, the school has become very successful. Attendance rates have gone right up. Achievement rates have improved. Test results have improved. There's a great atmosphere there. And Laurie herself was recognized as the MetLife Middle School Principal of the Year. Now, what it shows is that education is a human, personal process. And if you engage people at that level, you get much better results than if you disengage them through this relentless process of standardization.
And we leave it there. Sir Ken, thanks so much for talking today.
It's my great pleasure, Veronica. Thank you for having me on.
That was Sir Ken Robinson, creativity expert, author of several books on education, including his latest called Creative Schools.